On air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And coming up today, research into a mutant wheat variety that could lead to increased grain production.
We can make the plant produce more floral organs. And so this has really given us a new level of understanding about the biology of a wheat plant so that we can then go and do further investigation of how we could control this in a way that would either make more grain across the whole plant or make more grain within a particular floret or a spikelet.
And the Dorper sheep stud in southern Tasmania.
They shear themselves seasonally, the fibres will break and they'll just let their wool, they'll rub it off on a fence, or a lot of it just sheds naturally. The product we're producing is just meat rather than fleece and meat.
No shearers required at this sheep farm in Tasmania. We'll take you to the Dorper Sheep Stud during today's Country Hour to find out more. Also, coming up today, research into a mutant variety of wheat, which could mean extra production for farmers. Research that involves a number of countries around the world and a program that's been years in the making. Details of that coming up. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you on this Monday. The rain is coming down in many parts of the state. We'll check in with the Bureau at the halfway stage to find out what we can expect for the rest of the week. Also today, the alpacas were judged at the Royal Hobart Show over the weekend. We'll have the results coming up. Some good wins for alpaca farms in the north and northwest of the state. Details shortly. And the latest on food inflation data coming up. And you can stay in touch via that text line. 0438 922 936 is the number. First up today, we have the story about food inflation and what's been happening. You say every time you go to the supermarket, well, inflation on food is still affecting consumers at the checkout, despite a slight ease in some product prices. Egg prices were up 13.7% this September period compared to last year, while lamb and goat meat was up 10% according to the latest CPI index data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Rabobank senior analyst Michael Harvey explains the latest results.
On a year-on-year basis for the September quarter, we saw total food inflation running at 3.1%, which was slightly higher than it was the previous quarter, and it's mildly above the long-term average. But it's actually like something like six or seven quarters in a row that we've been around that 3% mark. So it is a much more normal rate of food inflation. But if you're a consumer, you're probably not wanting to see prices continuing to rise. You'd like to see some deflation. And that's where the story is still challenging for a lot of households, that you're not actually seeing much deflation. There was a couple of categories where there was mild deflation, but there was still broad-based inflation and a couple of clear standouts in terms of, you know, high prices causing headaches for consumers. It still feeds into a broader story that, I mean, clearly, you know, real incomes are rising again for consumers, and that's a positive. But clearly, you know, expectations around interest rate cuts are now shifting because of the inflation number that came out this week. So, you know, it's still a challenging market for Aussie households when it comes to their food purchasing because, yeah, you know, food prices are a lot higher than they were a couple of years ago, and we're not seeing much deflation. So it's still a challenging market.
What were some of those common foods that people were seeing a higher price for?
So the obvious one, I mean, egg pricing, which has been running at, you know, double-digit rates for a while now. So for the September quarter, it was just over 13% higher year on year. So that's quite significant. And that, no surprise, because obviously we've had some supply shortages on the back of the bird flu outbreak, which is leading to higher prices. So that's the obvious one. The other one that stands out, it's categorised as snacks and confectionery, and it was running at close to 7% year on year, which would be where the chocolate story comes through, because we've obviously had a period of very, very high global cocoa pricing, and that's seeing, you know, chocolate manufacturers needing to pass through that to consumers. So we're sort of at the tail end of that, but that was, you know, that's still quite high. And the other one that, you know, was flagged by retailers as well and is coming through in the data is obviously seeing, you know, livestock markets, which have firmed, leading through to higher prices. And that was particularly evident with lamb pricing at 10% year on year. So livestock, chocolate and eggs are the ones that are causing the most grief.
And yeah, it'd be interesting to see the next update. I've just been chatting with some egg farmers that are saying they're sort of starting to see a faster than expected bounce back from the egg industry and, yeah, seeing quite a bit more on the shelves. But yeah, we'll have to wait for the next data to see if that sees any price decrease too.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the broad expectation here, is that, you know, we should see food inflation continue to moderate and some of those challenges with those categories should normalise. And you talk about the egg supply response that will come through eventually. And you see also, you know, we're expecting, you know, chocolate prices to stop rising because global cocoa prices have now normalised on the back of much better supply and demand fundamentals globally, particularly with a rebound in production in West Africa. So there's certainly some global forces that are subsiding, which should mean a more normal rate moving forward. And some of those production issues locally in certain categories should improve as well. So, yeah, there's a broad expectation that there's no major issues for consumers moving forward. The key watch is clearly with fresh produce, though, you know, in terms of growing conditions. The fresh produce was actually quite mild in terms of food inflation in the most recent numbers, but we're obviously heading into summer. So it's a key watch on growing conditions for summer fruits and vegetables as well.
And dairy and meat also were standouts for having a bit higher inflation as well.
Yeah, I mentioned lamb is one where we saw 10% year on year, but there was a little bit of inflation coming back through on the dairy aisle, particularly milk, and that's just a reflection of the higher farm gate price to start this season that we've seen across Australia, and that starts to feed through into higher milk prices on the supermarket shelf. But the other one where it's been challenging is the oils and fats category, and there was two drivers there. You had very, very high global butter prices, which were putting upward pressure on the oil and fats category, and you also had a period of very high oil pricing for canola oil globally, and a lot of those global pressures are now starting to come through. So when you look at the oils and fats category that we saw this week, it was actually deflation of, you know, just around 1% deflation in that category, which is, yeah, so some global relief coming through on oils and fats.
Rabobank senior analyst Michael Harvey speaking with Eliza Berlage about the latest data on food prices in the September quarter. To the wheat industry now, and researchers from the University of Adelaide have helped to discover the gene responsible for a rare form of wheat that grows three ovaries per flower instead of one. But what could this mean for farmers and an increased yield? Scott Bowden is an associate professor at the university and part of the team that found the gene. He explained to Brooke Neindorf how the discovery came about and how it could help wheat farmers increase their grain yield and improve hybrid seed production.
So it actually started when I was back in the United Kingdom. I was working at a research institute called the John Innes Centre, and we were approached by breeders to try and investigate the genetic basis for a mutant that they had been working on in their breeding program. And this mutant was of interest to them because it produces 3 grain per floret, whereas a normal wheat plant only produces 1 grain. And so they were interested in how they might be able to work with this mutant to either improve their breeding programs or to understand yield-related traits. So, yeah, it was just through a connection with a breeder in the UK.
So this mutant gene, that just popped up and they thought, where has this come from?
Yeah, so it's been known about for 30 or 40 years now, and it was a spontaneous mutant line that happened in a field somewhere in China. A breeder noticed it there in China, and since then it's worked its way around the world to different international breeding programs to try and investigate whether it could help increase yield. And while it's been known about for this quite long amount of time, we weren't sure what was the genetic basis for it. So there was a bit of an intensive research effort to try and understand the gene controlling it. And that's happened not only in our group, but also in other groups who we collaborated with as part of this study, who are based at the University of Maryland in Washington in the United States. And there are also a few other groups in China who have been working on this particular line as well.
And you said before that it's 3 grains, but these are also known as ovaries in wheat. Is that right?
Yeah. So the basis of the 3 grains rather than producing 1 grain is because they produce 2 extra female reproductive organs. So each wheat flower, or floret as it's called, has female and male reproductive organs, and it normally self-pollinates. And so the male reproductive organs are called the anthers, and they release the pollen. And the female reproductive organs are called a pistil or a carpel, and one of the tissues within the carpel is known as the ovary, and that's what receives the pollen to then produce a grain through fertilisation.
So now this gene that's responsible for this extra growth, what happens now? What do you do with this information?
So that's a really good question. And one of the sort of emerging breeding technologies that is coming on the scene in Europe and the US, but will potentially come to Australia as well, is called hybrid breeding. So hybrid breeding has been used in corn and rice for many decades now. And it's a preferred breeding technique because it increases the yield of those plants through a phenomenon known as heterosis. And heterosis is basically where the progeny from a cross outperform either of the two parents that were used to make that cross. And so it's seen as a way of increasing yield, but there are also other benefits such as improving disease resistance and abiotic stress tolerance as well. One of the limitations for wheat has been the cost of doing that hybrid seed production. So they, at the moment, it costs too much to the breeders, so they then have to pass those costs on to the growers, and it's not quite a economically feasible model yet. So we're looking at technologies that could help us reduce that cost, and this particular mutant that makes three grain instead of one is one way that we could do that. At the moment, unfortunately, it's a dominant trait, and so this means that the parent will have it, but also the progeny. And so we want to try and work out a way that we can make it a recessive trait, which is by having the parent exhibit the trait or the three ovaries, but the progeny, they go back to producing one single grain rather than three.
And why would that be needed?
Well, so the reason why we would like to make the progeny only have one grain is because the farmers who have worked with us in this project don't really like the look of the grain that are made by these plants to make three grain. They're smaller, they're a little bit squashed. And while we haven't gone and tested it yet, we presume that they'll have less sort of starch and protein within the grain. So while it is favourable that they're making more grain, they make about 70% more grain than a normal plant, the grain that they make isn't quite up to standard yet. That, I guess that's another way that we might sort of pursue a line of investigation after this study, is can we breed with this line to make them produce bigger grain that are more like the grain of a normal plant? So even if a farmer was to grow this particular line out in their field, the grain would still be suitable for all the endpoint uses that we are common, you know, are common with wheat at the moment.
Because I imagine a lot of farmers and wheat breeders would be pricking up their ears going, oh, if we can, you know, have three grains instead of one, they're a bigger yield, but not necessarily a good thing across the board.
Yeah, so unfortunately there is a trade-off at the moment. That's often the case with changing things in a wheat plant, is there's often a trade-off. But what this study has taught us is that there are a set of cells that are used to make all of the above-ground biomass of a plant, the leaves, the stem, and the flowers. And so what this study has taught us is that by increasing the number of cells or increasing the organ that contains these cells, increasing the size of the organ, we can make the plant produce more floral organs. And so this has really given us a new level of understanding about the biology of a wheat plant, so that we can then go and do further investigation of how we could control this in a way that would either make more grain across the whole plant or make more grain within a particular floret or a spikelet.
Is it something that you could see in the near future that farmers will have access to?
That's a hope. This part of the study has sort of taken us 7 or 8 years to do. So we're working with breeders at the moment in Europe who had initialised our interest in the particular mutant to try and develop something that could be used by farmers. At the moment, it's a little bit unpredictable how long that might take, but it's something that we're continuing to investigate at the moment. I guess the only thing I'd like to add is that this was a real collaborative study that included people from the States, the UK, New Zealand and Australia. And without that combined effort, I don't think we would have been able to get to this sort of fantastic discovery.
University of Adelaide Associate Professor Scott Bowden speaking with Brooke Neindorf about their research into wheat. It's a rare form of wheat that grows three ovaries per flower instead of one. Now, coming up in just a moment, they were busy at the showground at the weekend judging the alpacas. We'll find out what happened.
During an emergency...
Power's not on, the line's still down, the tree's still on it.
Find your local ABC radio station.
Who's without power or phone, but hopefully listening to the ABC on a battery radio.
ABC Radio is your emergency broadcaster.
It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
We'll talk about Dorper sheep shortly and check on the weather in about 10, 15 minutes from now. 10.5 mil of rain in the gauge here at the ABC Hobart Studios. What's in your gauge? 0438 922 936. Well, the champion alpacas were judged over the weekend at the Royal Hobart Showgrounds. The north and the northwest of the state did very well. Alpaca steward Janelle Jago was also happy with the result in the fleece section from her Toffeymont alpaca farm at Orielton in the south of the state. I spoke to Janelle a little bit earlier today about the winners as she was preparing for shearing the alpacas in preparation for the next round of showing.
Our supreme champion Wakaya for 2025 was Tawawi Johnny Cash, exhibited by Tawawi Alpacas, and they're from the northwest coast of Tasmania. So congratulations to Stuart and Fiona.
And where did the name Johnny Cash come from? Obviously the singer.
They have quite a few animals named after famous people. I think I saw a King Charles there and a few others. So, yes, I'm sure he's been named after the famous Johnny Cash.
And what about the fleece, the champion fleece?
The supreme champion fleece was won by Toffeymont Kismi, owned by Toffeymont Alpacas, myself and Byron. Yeah, with a very high score of 81. So very, very impressed with that fleece.
Hey, you must be chuffed. Winning the Supreme, yeah.
Yes, yes, absolutely. We also won 5 championships and a few reserves. So, yeah, really, really happy with the day. And in the Suri section, because we have the 2 sections, Wakaya and Suri, the Supreme champion Suri for 2025 was Panda Lodge Warlock, and he is owned by Peter and Dusty Aspinall from Lilydale.
Okay, so a couple of prize-winning ones from the north of the state.
Yes, yes, very successful, yes, in the northeast and the northwest.
How were the entrants this year? Did you have big numbers?
We did. It's our highest numbers since COVID, which I was really, really impressed with. So we're slowly creeping up and recovering. So we had 80 halter exhibits and 60 fleeces. So that was some really good numbers this year.
And what about the young people? Are they getting involved more and more? Are you seeing that?
We had a few new breeders this year entering their show for the first time. So it was super exciting for some newbies coming in, and with a bit of mentoring, they had a fabulous day. And we had some young ones exhibiting as well. So one of our newer exhibitors, he's got a stud with I think around about 20 alpacas, and he won a championship as well, and I think he's 11 years old.
And what's his name?
His name is Alex Harmon.
Okay, very well done. What's the industry doing at the moment? How are things going? Is it looking good?
Yes, yes. We've seen a bit of growth across Australia, which is fantastic numbers. Of course, COVID, I think people just rethought their lives and sold their farms and moved on. And we had quite a few older breeders moving out of the industry, retiring out of the industry, which put a bit of a dent in the numbers there, and that's nationally. But especially here in Tasmania, we are recovering. We've had some new people come into the industry. The quality of the alpacas has increased. The judge's comments yesterday, you know, I had a chat to him about the caliber and the quality of the fibre and the exhibits that they were seeing yesterday. Were they on par with other mainland shows and other mainland qualities? And they assured us that we're really in the mainstream of things and holding our own here from Tasmania. So that's great news.
And are you hoping next year the show overall will be held at the showground if it's all finished?
Oh, yes. Wouldn't that be exciting? I'm super excited about moving back into the showgrounds. I have a feeling at least the animal exhibits will be in there. I'm not sure about the rest, but fingers crossed that we'll get there for 2026.
And on the farm at the moment, what's happening? Are you getting plenty of rain?
Oh, yes. So over the last 24 hours, we've received quite a few mil of rain, especially last night, which is terribly needed. Byron and I were just getting a little bit concerned and a bit thinking about ordering in all our feed and doubling up on it because we haven't had a lot, especially on the southeast coast, with our spring growth. So a little bit concerning. I don't think it's going to be as bad as last year, but, you know, when you've got 80 alpacas and I've got 20 crea on the way, you need to be prepared, I think. So just thinking forward, you know, if we don't get a lot of growth in that grass, you know, what's our forward plan around that? So,
and the shearers are there at the moment with the rain.
Yes, yes. So it was quite funny because Byron and I are heading off to the UK on Thursday, and I need to have my show team, Sean, today, because our next show will be the Royal Canberra show. And of course, we have to have enough fleece growth to be eligible to compete in February. So we have a very small window for fleece growth. And so when we came in at 8 o'clock last night from the Royal Hobart show, we checked the radars and we've penned them up. They're nice and dry. And our show team will be shorn this morning. So, and my husband and I will be shearing them. We do statewide shearing services across Tasmania. So, and then we're going to go on a much needed 20th wedding anniversary holiday to the UK.
Well, congratulations and well done. And hopefully the show back to its fullness next year again.
I certainly hope so, Tony. And we're really, really looking forward to that and embracing and celebrating the whole new complex. It's going to be super special.
Janelle Jago from Toffeemont Alpacas at Orielton on the judging at Royal Hobart over the weekend and the rain on the farm and a special break ahead on a UK trip with husband Byron. Safe journey. And I suspect there might be some visits planned to UK alpaca farms. Well, Brad says 5.5 mil at Stoner in the southern Midlands, long way short of 20 or 30 mil that was forecast. Thanks for that, Brad. We'll talk to the Bureau and find out some of the figures too. Now, just down the road from the alpaca farm is a farm called Logie Farm. Lachlan Van Barlen and his partner Lucy have worked all over the country in agriculture, but have settled on southern Tasmania as being one of their favourite places. They've been working on and managing Logie Farm, a Dorper sheep property near Richmond, for the past 3 years. Reporter Scout Wallen caught up with Lachlan and asked about the size of the property.
There's 320 hectares left in this valley floor of Logie Farm. It used to be a significantly bigger farm. It went all the way almost into Richmond. The former owners that had it, the Farrell family, when the patriarch of that family died, the sons were a little less interested in agriculture, as tends to be the case in succession. And so they divided some of it, which has gone under vines mostly, and, you know, producing some lovely wine. But, yeah, we've got this 320 hectare block left in the middle. And so the company that I work for, Gowings, is a wonderful Australian company who were established in 1868. And so they had some agricultural interests on the mainland, and particularly Dorper sheep. And they helped to build a really great Dorper stud in central western New South Wales, Burrawung, that had some top price rams a few years ago. And when that stud sort of reached its potential, they started looking around for ways to sort of establish that elsewhere. They had working with a South African fellow who did some land scouting and found this farm and thought that it would be ideal for developing a Tasmanian-based stud Dorper project, and so that's what we are here. So we started with 400 stud ewes from Burrawung, and then we've brought in a few local ewes where we can find them. We're up to about 500 head of breeders.
What do you think it was about this place that drew that South African scout to encourage them to come down here?
Look, I think the conditions, to be honest with you, it's the Mediterranean. It's some of the aspects that make it a real challenge to produce here, like the low rainfall and the sort of like the mixed sclerophyll sort of country and a bit of rocky country up the top is probably what makes it ideal for Dorpers. The breed developed in South Africa, and so they've some dry tolerance. Look, they're not fleece sheep, which is a bit controversial in Tasmania. They're self-shedding, so they shear themselves. Seasonally, the fibres will break and they'll just let their wool, they'll rub it off on a fence, or a lot of it just sheds naturally. The product we're producing is just meat rather than fleece and meat. We can just concentrate on developing a really quality line of high welfare meat sheep.
I was speaking to your lovely partner before, who said that you moved down about 6 years ago. What do you love about being in Tassie and being a farmer down here?
Most of it, to be honest. But yeah, we kind of loved it straight away. And then, I don't know, that forced reflection, I guess, through COVID, you couldn't travel far, and so we explored the state and just grew to love it more and more, I guess. But yeah, it's beautiful. The people down here are excellent. It's a real sense of community, I think. We're both from regional areas as well, grew up on farms or farm adjacent, and so yeah, I think we feel at home in a community where, yeah, like, I don't know, people have some responsibility for each other, and you can sort of build a reputation based on, I don't know, whatever, hard work and integrity and stuff, rather than, I don't know, the boarding school you went to, I guess, which is lovely.
What is your vision for the farm? I read that you're quite focused on sustainability. I guess, where do you see Logie Farms going?
Oh, look, strap in. part of the reason that the company bought the farm is to be environmentally responsible as well. So we have a soil carbon inset program here. So the company has a retail arm at some bricks and mortar shopping centres on the east coast of New South Wales, and we help to account for the carbon that they produce by sequestering it in the soil here. So yeah, we have a really strong focus on sustainable practices for that, amongst other reasons, essentially just doing the best we can by the land, but also being able to build in an insetting program where essentially the carbon, like I said, that some of the inevitable aspects of, you know, having retail spaces and stuff produces, being able to be environmentally responsible in our agricultural enterprise helps us to build an account for that. And look, that'll develop. Also, we're going to plant some olives. So we've got some olives going in for a little pressing project. Yeah, and look, and we'll develop sort of all aspects, basically. We'll keep developing our sheep genetics and concentrate, again, high welfare and also environmentally responsible meat production. We'll branch into cattle eventually and try and basically work all of these enterprises in with an environmentally positive aspect and try and go for that, you know, I don't know, that perfect sort of scenario of where we can be productive and economically productive and still responsible.
Is there a quarry on this property?
There is, yeah.
Yeah, can you tell me a little bit about the quarry here?
I can. At the moment, it's a red gravel quarry. At the moment, it doesn't operate. The easiest way for us to get the quarry to a point where we can rehabilitate it and get our bond back from the EPA is to operate it, to win the material, to bench it out properly so we can leave it in a sort of safe, I don't know, like a safe, I guess you'd call it like geological safe state. Hopefully we'll start operating again shortly and work towards getting to the point where we can incorporate that into all of the rest of the things we're doing as well.
Busy Farm, farm manager Lachlan Van Barlen talking there to Scout Wallen at Logie Farm just outside Richmond, farming Dorper sheep. Coming up on the Country Hour today, we'll talk daffodils, passion fruit research and rice. Plus, we'll check the latest on the weather. First up, the news headlines with Ellie Ward.
Thanks, Tony. An inquiry into September's Optus 000 outage that's been linked to 3 deaths has heard that Telco took 17 hours to inform the federal government that people had died in the incident. A review of last summer's mass mortality event in Tasmania's salmon industries identified a range of shortcomings in the response from government and industry. A bacterial disease caused mass salmon deaths from January to April in southeast waters, including dead fish and parts washing up on beaches. Independent MP Christy Johnston says she'll retable a private member's bill in Parliament this week that would return money stolen and used for gambling to victims. Initially tabled in February, its progress was halted due to July's snap state election. The bill aims to enable courts to make orders requiring gambling companies to return money when proven that stolen funds were used to gamble. And US Geological Survey issued an orange alert following a strong earthquake in Afghanistan. The magnitude 6.3 quake hit near one of the country's largest cities, Mazar al-Sharif, in the early hours of the morning. The orange alert indicates significant casualties are likely and the disaster is potentially widespread. More news at 1.
Time now to check the latest on the weather. A little bit of rain about. Ursula Connor joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Ursula.
G'day, Tony.
Up until midday, we had 10.5 millimetres at Hobart ABC Studios, and Brad tells us 5.5 mil at Stoner in the southern Midlands. More on the way?
Yeah, a little bit more. We've got this low pressure system sitting off the west coast. So we've just got this slow moving rain band moving across Tassie at the moment. So before 9 a.m. largely, we saw around sort of 20 to 30 millimetres pushing through the northwest of the state, particularly about those elevated parts. And then through the sort of the central plateau and the southeast, we've seen around 10 millimetres so far. And yeah, more like 1 to 5 millimetres elsewhere across the state. We're in a bit of a lull sort of between the heavier parts of the rain band at the moment, but we'll start to see these showers picking up again as we move into the afternoon and even the early hours of tomorrow morning. So we're still expecting another sort of 10 to 20 millimetres broadly across the whole state, Tony.
Okay, so a bit on the way. Any other rainfall figures for us specifically?
Well, we had the highest rainfall at the moment has been at Waratah. So they have just clocked over 30 millimetres, 32.4 to be specific. And it's really that area of sort of the elevated parts of the west. They've just seen, getting close to 30 millimetres through there.
Now, the rain continuing overnight into the morning. And what are we expecting from there?
Yeah, so the rain will start to clear about sort of the west and northwest overnight tonight, but it'll linger about the east and the southeast sort of through tomorrow morning. And then tomorrow afternoon we'll see a cold front sort of move over the state, so that'll bring our showers developing about sort of the northwest during the afternoon. But then through central and southeastern parts we'll also see some showers developing and possibly even some thunderstorms in that tomorrow afternoon. Behind that, the cold front will bring sort of some cooler southwesterlies that will persist sort of through Wednesday and Thursday. That's when we see those persistent showers pushing into the west coast. Not too much in the way of rainfall raking it through to the eastern parts of the state. In the later part of the week, sort of on Friday and maybe even into Saturday, it looks like there's going to be another low pressure sort of around the southeast of mainland Australia. So that could bring a bit more wet weather and rain sort of in a bit of an easterly flow late in the week and into the weekend, Tony.
Now, warnings, what have we got?
None for today, but into tomorrow we've got some winds increasing, so just a strong wind warning for the northern coastal waters. That one extends from Low Rocky Point around to Wineglass Bay, and there is also a warning to sheep graziers for King Island.
What sort of temperatures are we at the moment, Ursula?
At the moment, the warmest place is St Helens, currently 20 degrees. Elsewhere across the state, Hobart is currently 17, Launceston 18, Devonport and Wynyard 14, and also 14 in Strawn at the moment.
And overnight, not getting down to the temperatures we saw last week, the down near zero?
No, sticking around that sort of 9 to 12 degree mark for most of the major centres overnight tonight.
Okay, and the coastal waters and swell, what's happening out there?
Today we've got northwesterly winds sort of around 10 to 20 knots, but they're tending north to northeasterly about the east coast. In terms of the swells in the west, we're looking at a west to southwesterly slowly building to 2 to 3 metres today. In the south, a southwesterly around 2 metres and also a northeasterly around 1 metre. In the north, a bit of a confused swell sort of below 1 metre and then in the east and northeasterly of 1 to 2 metres. The Cape Sorrel Buoy has just clocked 2 metres out of the southwest for the sig wave height. And Maria Island sitting at 1.8 from the northeast.
Have you got the maxes for those two?
Yeah, that was the max sig wave heights there.
Beauty. Thanks, Ursula.
Cheers, Tony. Have a good one.
You too. Cheers. Ursula Connor there from the Bureau with details of the weather coming up for you. Some more rain on the way. Hopefully, Brad, you'll get some more in Stoner in the beautiful southern Midlands. We need the rain in particularly those areas of the state, don't we? Okay, coming up in just a moment, we'll talk daffodils.
It was 20 years ago that Spicks and Specks began to play.
The anniversary tour is back with 8 new episodes.
Correct.
Join Adam, Miff and Alan for brand new Spicks and Specks. Sunday nights on ABC TV and ABC iView.
On air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Plenty of great stories online at ABC Rural and our ABC Rural Facebook page. You might catch up with the story that Larissa did over the weekend on the landline about the 20th anniversary of the protest. The tractor protest on the mainland, and it's online as well. Great story there too. Well, plant scientist Richard Perignon says his love for daffodils goes back to gardening with mum. Growing his first one in his late teens, his passion continued growing as he travelled to different daffodil shows around the country. Fiona Breen caught up with him to hear just what it is that piques his interest in that particular bloom.
Well, it's they bloom once a year like most things, I suppose, and they come out in spring, and they're pretty well the earliest flower in spring. So you emerge from a rather miserable cold winter and they're one of the first things that spring out of the ground at you. And they're a brilliant gold colour. And when they're seen in mass, they're like nothing else.
And was there an original daffodil, or has there always been many types of daffodils, or have these been developed over the years?
Look, I think the most common daffodil that any Australian has come across has always been King Alfred, which was the staple for cut flower trumpet daffodils from the Second World War on and probably before. But over the years, thousands of cultivars have been brought to market. They're all you can find them all on an American website called daffseek.org. And the British have a register of them, the International Daffodil Register. Really, between Britain and America, they're the main breeding continents, the Dutch perhaps to a lesser extent. And they have been breeding this particular flower since the 19th century at least. One might argue even since the 18th century.
What are the perfect spaces for daffodils? What do they like?
Well, daffodils, number one, like water. And they like it in winter and spring, because they die down at the end of spring. So they're herbaceous plants. And they like it cold. They don't like it hot. When the hot weather comes on, they die away quickly. And you want your bulb to stay green as long as possible, the leaves to stay green as long as possible, so that it can store starches for the next year's growth.
Are they the sort of flower that you should dig up every year, or...?
Not at all. Narcissus are part of the amaryllis family, for instance, hippiastrums, and they like to be left untouched, at least for a few years. If they're successful, they'll colonise, so they multiply and you get great clumps of them. They can if they multiply a great deal, they can start competing with one another, and that's when you need to divide the clump. But that shouldn't happen for a few years.
And what's your favourite daffodil? Do you have a favourite?
One of the thousands. Perhaps I should tell you, Pseudonarcissus is only one of about a dozen species of daffodils, and there are all sorts of different species. And each of those species has been hybridised, like Pseudonarcissus itself. And so there are what we call standard-sized daffodils, which is like King Alfred, or there are miniature daffodils, which are about 6 inches tall, perhaps a little bit smaller, and they can go down to a thumbnail. And then there's intermediates, which is all sorts of things in between. So it's rather hard to say which is your favourite. Right now, I suppose my favourite is a daffodil bred by Rod Barwick, and it's called Taz Rival. And it's a biggish daffodil, and I'll tell you why I like it. It's because it combines the size and form of, say, King Alfred. There's a long trumpet and nice wide perianth or petals. And it combines with the form of a little daffodil called Narcissus cyclamenius, which was found in the early 20th century in the far north of Spain in a wooded area. And that has its little petals completely reflexed, just like a cyclamen flower, if you can imagine that. And it gives a sort of an anthropomorphic aspect to the flower. It looks like a human being with a big nose, big snout. And Rod Bowick has combined these two characteristics, the size and presence of pseudo-Narcissus with the grace and elegance of Narcissus cyclamenius in one cultivar, which he calls Taz Rival.
And of course, Rod Bowick is well known for his daffodils in Tasmania.
He is indeed, but he's even better known overseas. He's world famous.
And tell me, how difficult is it to be a judge? And what sort of things are you looking for? I think we've got a hint of that in the last answer.
It's not difficult to be a judge. You just have to be familiar with the various species and types of daffodils and classes of daffodils. For instance, within pseudo-Narcissus, there are three sizes, if you like. There's the trumpet, whose what we call the corona or trumpet exceeds the length of the trumpet exceeds the diameter of the petals. You've got a large cup where the length of the trumpet is not quite as much as the diameter of the petals, but greater than, I think, a third. And then you have cups that are smaller than that. We call those small cups. So there are all those sorts of technicalities, but they're easy. You know, you just need a good book and yep, you'll get on top of that within half an hour. Look, the tough thing about judges is trying to agree with the other judges. Basically, everyone has their own view as to which is the best.
Yeah, that's plant scientist Richard Perignon talking to Fiona Breen about the beautiful daffodil bulbs. Well, remember, back to the COVID era, there were plenty of shortages on the supermarket shelves. One of the shortages, obviously, was the toilet paper. But remember, you couldn't find rice anywhere. Well, southern New South Wales rice growers are cutting back plantings this season as low water allocations curb production across the Murray and Murrumbidgee valleys. Sunrise chair and Blighty farmer John Bradford says although the crop will be significantly down on last year's record 500,000-ton harvest, supply remains strong. Mr. Bradford told Cara Jeffrey the company is carrying plenty of rice in storage after three good seasons, and there'll be no repeat of COVID-era shortages on supermarket shelves.
It was a record-breaking crops last year. We got the highest crop yield in the world, so it went really well. 500,000 ton last year, and some of the highest yields ever recorded in the district. So unique conditions. We may not replicate that this year, but it was a terrific season to grow last year.
And with it looking like smaller plantings at this stage, is that going to affect the availability for consumers and the domestic level? And with Sunrise servicing 50 markets across the world, will that also impact export customers if you have a lot less rice in the system to meet demand?
Luckily, this is the back of three good years, and Sunrise is carrying a lot of rice over in storage. Plus what we're doing now, we'll have a full milling program for C26. One of the things that Sunrise has done because of water variability and buybacks is we've gone sourcing rice in other areas, and that's one of the strengths of Sunrise. We know rice really well, and we can source similar quality sort of rice. Australia's got the best rice in the world for medium grain. You know, we lead it with the yield, the taste, the water use, methane emissions, the whole lot. But it is probably a little bit reduced, but we've got a full milling program for this year, which is the main thing.
So there won't be any scenes like there was in COVID of the shelves stripped bare of rice. There's not going to be anything like play out like that on the back of a smaller crop?
No, not at all. But it is mindful that the government has to understand about food security, and COVID did show that, you know, between toilet paper and rice, they were the first two things to go off the shelf, is that you do need capability within Australia, and buybacks into the future is not something you don't want to see, the reduction in area and volume within the Riverina. You know, we provide a lot of food to Australian and underpin the stability of rice in Australia.
Sunrise is also such a large employer in towns like Deniliquin and Leeton with the mills, and then the storage facilities for delivery in other smaller areas. So will there be reduced operations at those places this season?
Slightly. It depends on the crop. It's too early to say what's going to happen. But one thing about Sunrise is that we're very resilient, and because we've got good carryover, there's a full requirement.
And turning the attention now to your own farm at Blighty, how is rice planting progressing there at the moment, and how do things compare at your place to last year?
Very good. Last year I had a lot of rain, probably not the opportune time. I've got 50 hectares and it looks fantastic. It's probably just hitting two leaf stage. It's been watered twice. Very happy with the progress. Would like a little bit warmer weather than we've had the last couple of days. Looking forward to a little potential rain as well, which will help it on its way.
Have you had to look into that temporary trade for water this year or carry over to get things through with the allocation only at 18% in your patch?
I've purchased some water very early on. I had carried over water for a rice program as well. So I'm covered for the water this year, but I do know that an extra allocation would be helpful.
How are your winter crops looking at your place at the moment?
My winter crops are looking a little bit sad from lack of rain, but it's been the first year in about 10 years that my hay had no rain on it, and it's fantastic quality. So there is a little bit of bright side of not having rain for my hay, but it's terrific quality, but it came from the downside for my cereals not looking as good.
And with the water allocations that will be announced on Monday, are you confident that there could be a lift in that percentage for the Murray and Murrumbidgee irrigators?
It's hard to know. There's the impact of the Menindee Lakes and the water flowing in there, which might change the numbers a little bit, but I'm always wishful. You know, I'm an optimist, so I'm hoping for the best.
Looking ahead, what message do you want to send to growers and policymakers about keeping the rice industry viable under these tough water conditions?
That's exactly right. Look, if the future of buybacks, I think, you know, the government's acquired a lot of water already. I'd say use that first. Do a review and see whether you need more water or not before you go back to the market and just buy straight buybacks. And the other thing is protect the industries that are here already that employ a lot of people in the Riverina. You know, we're one of the few value-adding companies in the Riverina, and we value our employees, and we just want to make sure the government chooses policy that actually they understand that it's, you know, the environment, the social and the economic. And the social part's very important that they need to realise that the impacts of buybacks.
And finally, it's your first season in the hot seat as chair of Sunrise, following on from the role that Laurie Arthur from Moolamine held for 18 years as the leader. So what are your priorities stepping into that position of leadership?
The one thing that I do want to do is re-engage with our growers and listen to our growers. And there's exciting times post-vesting. We have new opportunities, and as I said, we want to become, you know, Sunrise, the crop of choice, anyone that's got water in the Riverina into the future.
Well, you wanted to know about rice. That was the new Sunrise chair, John Bradford, who farms at Blighty in southern New South Wales, speaking to Cara Jeffrey about the water allocations and what's happening with the rice industry. Now, researchers are racing the clock to provide Australia's passion fruit growers with new varieties to keep them in business. A previous research program co-funded by farmers failed to get results, but the Queensland Alliance for Agriculture and Food Innovation, a collaboration between the Uni of Queensland and Queensland Government, has expanded the search around the nation and overseas. Jen Nichols joined researchers in the passion fruit research patch on the Sunshine Coast.
It's a beautiful flower that we're looking at.
Yeah, you can see the blue colour here, and it is beautiful. And yeah, we use this one. One of the reasons is if we can identify this is tolerant to different stresses, like high temperature. Yeah, hello, Mubashir Alam. So you can call me Mo. I'm leading National Passion Fruit Breeding Program.
You're doing some very important work, because the plants that growers have been using, there's some problems with them.
Yes, for the varieties, yield decline is happening. The size of the fruits are getting reduced. Growers are not making much profit. We want to release new varieties that are profitable for the industry, that can produce optimum fruit size, that have good flavor.
What's involved in breeding passion fruit?
The first thing is really important. We should have good germplasm. So that's the collection of these different varieties that have different good traits. We call it germplasm, and you can call it genetic resource. Unfortunately, we didn't have when we started the breeding program, but our team did a fantastic job, and we collected a lot of germplasm within Australia and from abroad as well. So that's the way we expanded our genetic resources, and that also helped us to develop new varieties quickly. And then we have selected nearly 20 new accessions for the industry at this moment. We'll see how do they grow in grower's plot in next year.
So the accessions are the different genetic results of different seeds?
Yes, results of differences. Even if we have collected from the same plant, the seeds are different. So that one we have selected is an accession.
So when did this project start?
Started in April 2023. But we believe we made a good progress, because that genetic resources we expanded over the last 2 years, and we selected some new promising accessions for the industry. Usually within 1 year, we select one plant only. So then from one plant we are multiplying. We have multi-location trials, so that gives us more opportunity to multiply them to apply in commercial orchard.
So in the plant world, this is pretty speedy.
It is much better than macadamia. I have been working with macadamia as well. It took 24 years to release a variety. But here, hopefully within 3 years, we'll be able to select a good one. And within 5 years, we'll be able to give it to the growers. So it's very fast.
Dr. Mo Alam from the University of Queensland. Patrick Mason is another researcher from the University of Queensland. You've been involved in this work too?
Yes. I actually moved from a more of a fundamental genetics background to Mo's lab, which is very much involved in breeding, macadamia, and more recently passion fruit. So I've actually only been here for a year and a half, but at the end of the day, I love passion fruit. It's my favourite thing to work with. It tastes good, and I eat far too much of it, so I feel sick sometimes. I'll be out in the field. Every fruit that I say I have to try, it's all good. I love it.
Well, I guess the passion for passion fruit is a good thing to have when you're researching them.
Absolutely. Yeah, I just hope that trying all the fruits that I've been doing, hopefully it ends up with a good result for the farmers and good quality fruit for the consumer.
It's challenging to be a farmer with all of the impacts of extreme weather, rising costs of production. How crucial is this work to passion fruit still being grown in Australia?
Oh, it's very crucial. The industry is very much over reliant on a small set of varieties. And so there has been a little bit of work by some other breeders who are farmers, but they've done a bit of breeding work, like Keith Paxton, for example. He's produced a couple of good varieties. But at a fundamental level, we can't be reliant on just a couple of varieties for the entire industry because there's a lot of different areas. They've all got different disease pressures and different climatic zones. And so you need to have, I'd say, a large number of accessions that farmers can pull from so they can really cater production to their farm and use varieties that work best in their farm. So it's very crucial, and moving forward, they're going to need a constant stream of varieties available. So one of the other issues that we have in the passion fruit industry is that it's a clone. So when you've got your good variety, you're basically taking cuttings from that and you're producing something that is exactly the same, it's genetically similar. But over time, kind of like humans develop cancer and other things, you know, you get little mutations in your genome. Sort of a similar thing happens with plants as well, where they'll develop these mutations and over time that'll affect productivity. So if you continue to do lots and lots of cloning, you'll produce these somaclonal mutations and that affects production. And that's actually happened. Two of the most popular varieties, which have been fantastic back in the 90s, Sweetheart and Misty Gem. Everyone was using them. Everybody loved them. Nowadays, they're basically unusable. The fruit size is too small and the productivity is poor as well. So we've had to move away from those. And so that just shows how important it is to have new varieties constantly coming through to keep that productivity up. And again, that will ensure that the farmer's bottom line will be maintained. We're lucky to have two varieties at the moment that are in their advanced stages, and with a congregation of passion fruit farmers, we've put out calls for them to trial these varieties on their property. And so once we see interest and they're happy with these particular varieties, if that is the case, then we can go through the process of getting it protected with plant breeders' rights, and then we can release it to the broader passion fruit industry and they can start growing. And so we're hoping to do that by the end of 2027.
Passion fruit researcher Patrick Mason talking there to Jen Nichols about research into new varieties of passion fruit. And I'll put a podcast of today's program up for you very shortly, Another Country Hour, after midday tomorrow.